The Tom Woods Show, episode 2295.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Come on now, folks. If you ain't going to start that side hustle now, then when? Check out my free ebook, Five Paths to an Online Income, where I take you step by step through five things that I do that keep food on the Woods household table and how you can do them too. Check it out at pathstoincome.com. Hey, everybody. Tom Woods here. I am delighted to be joined by health writer Gabrielle Bauer, who has written a very, very worthwhile new book called Blindsight is 2020, Reflections on COVID Policies from Dissident Scientists, Philosophers, Artists, and More. Gabrielle, I have to say, this is rather a unique collection. I thought it was going to be a series of submissions from all these people, and so it would be an anthology of sorts, but instead, it's actually all you. But what you're doing is, in each chapter, you're putting forth the strongest case for each person's point of view, and you're summarizing each person's point of view for us. And I actually think that works better because, for whatever reason, my agent and other book publishers have told me that people just don't buy anthologies for some reason. And by the way, as somebody who has published an anthology, I can tell you, they just don't. But I like what you've done is that you're somebody who, like me, read everything you could about this while it was happening. You got a wide variety of perspectives. And what you're doing here is showing the array of arguments and insights from a variety of people. It wasn't all people saying exactly the same thing. A lot of people had different takes on it. I mean, you have musicians, you have people talking about immunity, you have people talking about public health, you have people talking about the liberty, freedom, libertarian aspect of the question, and you've brought them all together here, I think, very effectively.
Thank you. Yeah, that was my key purpose in writing the book, because as you know, from the beginning, we were told, follow the science, follow the science, follow the science. And that statement is wrong on many levels, which I can get to later. But one of the things missing from this whole discourse was, where are the other perspectives? A pandemic is not just a scientific phenomenon. It's a human challenge. And the artists, philosophers, bioethicists, lawyers, economists, they all have equally important contributions to make on the ethical and societal impact of a pandemic and pandemic policies. So I thought it was really important to go beyond that. Oh, we only listen to scientists here.
Right. And of course, that's, as you may know, one of the things that drove me crazy through the whole thing, because even if the science, so-called, had been unimpeachable.
Yeah, that's exactly.
There's more to life than just this thing.
Exactly, exactly. You get it. You obviously get it. And a lot of people don't. When you say, well, follow the science doesn't work, they might say, yeah, it doesn't work because science is always changing and all that. But that's not really the point. As you said, even if the science were perfectly settled, a pandemic is not just a scientific phenomenon. There's all these human aspects and, you know, how to shepherd the human family through this without breaking our spirit. That's not a question that virologists or epidemiologists can answer.
No. And the thing is that they're not trained to answer it. As I kept saying, there's no class that Anthony Fauci took in school that teaches him, in a situation like this, here's how you balance all the relevant considerations. There is no such class. So
exactly,
we're attributing to them superhuman powers that none of them possess.
That's so true. Even if there was a class, I mean, they are trained to only look at that one thing. Actually, one of the people that I interviewed for the book, who is an epidemiologist, Mark Woolhouse, he wrote a book called The Year the World Went Mad. And he's actually a lockdown skeptic, even though he's sort of on the inside track of government advising. He said that this pandemic was driven too much by epidemiologists, the response, because they were told not to worry about the other aspects. They were told not to worry about mental health and economics and children's development and all these things. They were specifically told not to, and that was someone else's job. But whose? As Mark Woolhouse says, nobody stepped up to do that job.
That's right. That's right. And even Fauci, who was a virologist rather than an epidemiologist per se, when he was asked, now, I can't cite this. I don't know where the citation is. So if somebody were to challenge me on it, I'd have to just throw my hands in the air and say, you've got to take my word for it. But I know in my newsletter, it wasn't until, I don't know, a solid 6 months had passed before Fauci was prepared to concede that there might be collateral effects of lockdowns. He was asked, have you considered that you're also at the same time doing X, Y, and Z to people? His answer was flat out no.
Yes.
No, I haven't considered that.
That's right. Yeah, because they have just been trained to just consider that one nail with their hammer and ignore all the other nails. Yeah, it's awful, really.
One of the people you have in here in Chapter 5 is Martin Kulldorff, who's on leave currently from Harvard Medical School. I've had him on several times. I had lunch with him in Boston. I've gotten to know him. He's a great guy. He's soft-spoken. He's not somebody who seeks the limelight. He's not a populist leader who's going to storm the White House with pitchforks and torches. He's not that type. But he is, in his area that he knows about, very insistent on his expertise and his knowledge. I did poke fun at him. But the last time I had him on, I said something along the lines of, I think this crisis has revealed something about the field of epidemiology, because I'm not sure that this, just based on what we saw over the past 3 years, maybe this discipline is not quite ready for prime time. Because not only were wild predictions made that did not come true, I mean, we were supposed to have a big, big spread after the Super Bowl and all these sorts of things were supposed to happen. And nobody could explain why we didn't. But beyond that, I told him about a survey that I guess the Washington Post had taken of epidemiologists, now only several dozen of them. They were asking them things like, which of the following things would you discourage people from doing, or are you yourself afraid of doing? And it was all these sort of basic things anybody might want to do on a daily basis. And a strong plurality of them were afraid to go out and get the mail.
Yeah.
So I think there's something the matter with these people. I don't know what the kind of person who's drawn to epidemiology is, that maybe it's just oddball hypochondriacs tend in that direction. I don't know, but there's something the matter with them. You know, I'm just going to flat out say it. There's something the matter with a lot of them.
Yes. Yeah. It's just this lack of proportionality really drove me crazy as well.
Now, you have a lot of people in this. I mean, it's dozens and dozens of people whose views you're presenting to us here. But do you have any particular favorites, ones who just struck you so much that you almost felt like anybody giving this person a real chance is almost compelled to accept this person's point of view?
Yeah, I don't know about compelled to accept, because people do tend to dig in their heels often.
I know. And as I was saying it, I thought, I don't know if any argument is strong enough to compel assent in this situation.
Because it really, I think it all comes down to worldview. There are some people that have such a particular biomedically focused worldview, and they think that preventing or trying to prevent catching a disease takes precedence over everything else. And if you hold that worldview, then all these crazy measures make some degree of sense. I mean, I think that that worldview is completely anathema to me, but I think there are some people who just can't be convinced. But having said that, the people, I guess, who are closest to my heart that I feature in Chapter 9, I feature two novelists, the writers, Matthew Crawford and Lionel Shriver. Lionel Shriver is a woman. She is the author of the famous We Need to Talk About Kevin. And the chapter is called A Plea for Freedom. And they speak eloquently about what freedom means and the role of freedom in a pandemic. And is freedom just something for fair weather that we jettison, that we abandon when the times get rough? So that really spoke to me, because that was one of my own self-discoveries as well during the pandemic. I'd never really thought of myself as being particularly freedom-oriented. I think it was just because I was living in a free society and it was in the background. So I didn't really think about it that deeply. And then when the pandemic came along and I saw freedoms being taken away one after the other, I realized how important it was on my own moral compass. And whenever I found kindred spirits, which fortunately, over time, I found plenty, I cheered for them especially.
You have a chapter I want to say a little bit about involving musicians. There's one or two I want to focus on. I did an issue in my email newsletter not too long ago involving Van Morrison, the second time I've talked about him in this context, because very recently he was interviewed in a music magazine. And after the interview, which did not at all touch on his opinions of the lockdown, even though that's probably what has been most talked about regarding Van Morrison over the past few years, he posed a series of 18 questions to his interviewer about, do you think we should all just have complied? Are you opposed to people like me who protested? Are you aware of the agenda of the World Economic Forum? This is coming out of Van Morrison.
Right.
And he wrote a little bit about this. He wrote a couple of songs related to lockdown. So can you talk about Van Morrison a little bit? Because I, like anybody, I kind of liked Van Morrison before this, but I think I like him a lot more now.
Yeah, same here. Well, I think it's interesting because he's 80 years old by now. He was 77, 78 when this all started. And he didn't need to make any more money. He's
right.
Very rich and very famous. And he really could have just sat home and watered his roses or whatever. But he felt that performing was such a fundamental human activity, connecting, bonding, elevating activity, that he had to stand up and speak up for it. And that's what really made me admire him a lot. Because as I say, he didn't need this. There's a lot of musicians that did need it. I speak about this as well in the book. As you mentioned, I weave in a lot of my personal experiences and experiences of people I know. And my daughter was and is a local musician, and all that was suddenly cut off. And she reached the point also where she started going, well, wait a minute. So these things that everyone said are important, they're actually not important. We just throw them away indefinitely. And there were so few people who spoke out in favor of music and culture and live performing and all these things, and acknowledged that these things were a part of being human. They're not just frills. All these things are, in aggregate, what make us human and what make life worth living. So I think to some of us, just the way that these things were summarily thrown away, and you were not allowed to discuss it. If you even bring it up, you're a granny killer, end of story. That was so disappointing and demoralizing. So the few musicians, like Van Morrison being one of them, who spoke up for these things really deserve our admiration.
Yeah, and you're exactly right that, of course, he has plenty of dough and he has all the fame he needs. So really, this is only a matter of principle for him.
Yes, exactly.
And
exactly.
All he's going to get from this is grief. Nothing but grief.
Exactly.
And he did it anyway. And there were a handful of others, but not a whole lot. Not a whole lot. And of course, we might extrapolate from what you said that up-and-coming musicians don't dare speak out because they'll be destroyed reputation-wise before they even get out of the gate, because nobody's allowed to have a dissident opinion on this. Can you talk about Dave Mustaine from Megadeth? Because he interests me. He doesn't get political all that often, but when he does, I think he has some dissident opinions. And I don't think he's a coward. I think his view, my suspicion is, look, I'm here to make music. I'm not a propagandist. I'm not a controversialist. I have my opinions, and I'll tell them to you if you ask, but that's not mainly why I'm here.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, he has like a shorter section in the book. And what's interesting about him is he started out on the so-called pro-lockdown side. He was encouraging his fans to stay home and hunker down until things got better. But again, I think he just reached a point where he began to question, okay, where's the end point here? And then he switched. I talk about him in a concert just telling his fans, you know, isn't this amazing, the energy here? You know, we're not sitting with our masks. We're just feeling this energy, which is so uplifting and important. So I admire people who change their minds and who are willing to revisit their previous positions.
I saw him in whatever year it was, sometime during this crazy, maybe it was last year, 21 or 22, I don't remember, but it was at the Reno Events Center in Purple, Nevada, and they still had a mask mandate indoors, especially for a venue like this. So the way we all did it was everybody walked in wearing a mask, and when you walk in, you're in the outer part of the event center where they have the merchandise and the concessions, and then you open a further door, it takes you actually into the theater itself. And the second you opened that door, you looked around and 80% of people were unmasked. And nobody did a thing about it. Nobody declared it's a public health emergency. We have to shut down the event. Nope. We all knew in our hearts that it was all stupid. We all knew that it didn't seem to do anything, even though we didn't have any studies or they were starting to trickle out. But we all kind of knew the world would look different if these things did anything. The world would look different.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, that was nice to see. And again, all the official responses to these artists were so dreary and they just didn't get it. You know, I speak in the book about this Rolling Stone magazine article that criticized Mustaine for speaking out and scolded him for disregarding his own heart status because he had had throat cancer.
Yeah.
Again, as though people were just these automatons whose only objective in life is to reduce risk as much as possible.
Yeah, and like Dave Mustaine needs to be told what his own interests are by Rolling Stone magazine.
Exactly. You
know, I think I'm a pretty good assessor of what I need in my life right now.
Yeah.
And what I need is this. So, by the way, I'm just jumping around completely at random here, but you do have a chapter that talks about several journalists like Glenn Greenwald, who Glenn Greenwald has very much upset many of his former supporters because he is just consistent. He doesn't like the modern center-left, left liberal movement at all because it's just full of hypocrisy and latching onto dumb causes or fake made-up causes. But I don't know exactly, I mean, of course, you talk about it, but what his precise evolution on this was, because I don't know if his knee-jerk approach would be, well, we have to go along with the lockdowns, especially because he lives in Brazil. He's been critical of the political establishment in Brazil, and Brazil tried under Bolsonaro to be fairly laissez-faire. So I think it might be hard for Greenwald to go along with that. So where was he coming from on this?
Well, I want to just address what you said about political orientation, because yes, people like Greenwald and Matt Taibbi as well, very similar in that they come from a left place politically, but they just got disgusted progressively with what the left was doing. And I think that that represents my own political journey as well. I come from sort of center-left background, but I've become—
Really? All the way up until COVID?
Yeah, I would say center-left with some reservations. You know, for instance, I'm fiscally conservative. I don't like this idea of spend, spend, spend. But yeah, I would call myself center-left. I mean, I still do believe in things like universal healthcare, which we have here in Canada. If it's done right, it's not done right here. And again, I believe in universal healthcare, but with some fiscal restraint. And I also believe in keeping people housed as much as possible, things like that. So, but then when I saw what the left had become, just so immersed in these ridiculous ideological wars and group identity and identity politics, I just got disgusted and I joined the increasing ranks of people who call themselves politically homeless. So I think something similar happened to Greenwald as well. And one of the things that he keeps coming back to is the hypocrisy. He actually wrote a book about hypocrisy long before COVID, about the hypocrisy in politics. And I think when COVID came along, that hypocrisy was just, it really brought out the hypocrisy in politicians who clearly did not think this was an extinction level threat because of all the parties they had and the Caribbean islands they went to and so forth. But they just kept on with that apocalyptic messaging. And he really cottoned on to that and exposed it. That was one of his big things.
So in your case, I mean, I realize that, see, in this book, you talk about all kinds of other people, but I'd like to talk about you for a minute, because that is an interesting evolution. I had Dr. Pierre Corey on the show, who was, I don't know what his politics were before this, but the impression I got was, you know, he was busy as a doctor and he just didn't really give issues like that very much thought. And then this came along and he would read in the New York Times all kinds of nonsensical statements about subjects he knew about. And he began to think, if they speak out of their you-know-whats about things I know about and they're so wrong, how many times have they spoken about things I don't know about and been so wrong? So
right.
It opened his eyes to other things. So I wonder in your case, I mean, it has to be very bewildering. I mean, for somebody like me, I'm very, very skeptical of all kind of establishment outlets and official agencies and stuff. But I understand why somebody would think, well, the experts are running the CDC, the various health agencies around the world, and I have no good reason not to trust their good judgment. But then suddenly to see them all in unison doing such destructive things, I mean, I assume this must have been rather a shock.
It was, but you know, to me, I would say the bigger shock and the bigger thing that got me disgusted with the current modern version of the left was this constant moralizing, what we call the virtue signaling, just nonstop virtue signaling and this assumption that they have the moral high ground and the shaming. I was 63 years old when this started. I'm 66 now. And No one had ever called me a sociopathic, mouse-breathing, flat earther, whatever, before and in all my life. And suddenly, when I ventured an opinion against these policies online, all these epithets were hurled at me. And again, that constant, oh, you're an ableist and you're a eugenicist and ist, you know, that constant lumping of all these identities onto people for expressing an opinion. I just got so tired of it, so tired of that whole culture, I guess is what I would call it. I talk about COVID culture because there really was a culture that developed around this virus. And it was so tiresome and so sanctimonious and so thought-stopping. And I think that that whole ideological framework and vibe really turned me off.
I thought that surely after a few months of this, there would be cracks in the facade. Even in the entertainment community, which is completely brain dead, I thought even they have to break free of this. Because, you know, they want to make movies, I assume, right? They want the money to keep coming in. So they'll come up with some reason that all of a sudden we have to abandon this. And not only did they not, but so much of the, not just American public, but Canadian and much of the world, and in Asia, the conformity was just overwhelming. I mean, absolutely overwhelming. In the Philippines, for example, there was no dissident movement to speak of. Everybody just did as they were told. Guess what I thought was people value their lives and they value the rich experiences, the irreplaceable experiences they have in their lives. And they realize that time is precious and being asked to sacrifice an indefinite chunk of that is an enormous thing to ask of them. So I thought people would at least start fishing around for alternatives, you know, to see, is there anybody saying that maybe this is a bad idea? Is there anybody saying that maybe we'd be better off if we just resumed normal living? And relatively few people did that. And that just amazes me that you value your life so little. Now, I know what they'll say. Oh, it's that I value my life so much. I want to protect myself against the virus. But we all know now that this was overblown. I think we all know, we have to know that. And we also have to know that we can look at different places that did different things and it doesn't, none of it seems to have made a difference. So even that argument doesn't mean anything. It just boggles my mind that more people didn't say anything or do anything.
No, I know you touched on so many issues just in what you just said now. Yes, that was a big revelation for me as well. Just the shock, you know, and I've thought very deeply about all these things and just shock. I assumed that I thought pretty much the same way as other people did about these things, about life, about what we're here for, about... And then it was such a shock for me to realize that my point of view actually was not mainstream. I really would not have predicted it. You know, that all these people that I knew, my associates, my colleagues were just going nuts over this virus and were so willing to reduce life to this biological metabolic survival. You know, and I touch on that in the book because I feature some philosophers and those questions really interest me a lot. The big questions and the people were so willing to sort of jettison everything that constitutes meaningful living, as you said. And sure, you can say, okay, for 2 weeks, for a month, but people were willing to do it indefinitely. And that also completely blew my mind. But the nice thing is, now we're 3 years into it, and there's still the Twitter holdouts who are lecturing everyone about wearing masks and, oh, you know, you don't know who's immunocompromised and all that, as though that justifies holding the whole world under siege. But the nice thing is that human nature is finally asserting itself. We walk outside, you know, I've been to concerts, I've been to large medical conferences. I go to a lot of those all over the world, full of doctors, none of them masked. People are going to restaurants, no one's putting on masks. So I feel that in the past, well, since the beginning of this year, really, there's been a shift and human nature is winning. So I think we're winning this war. It's a war of attrition. It's taken a hell of a lot longer than... Yeah. I would have liked, than you would have liked. But you know what? All these things that people said would never come back. All these behaviors. So many people said, travel as we do it will never come back. Handshakes will definitely never come back. No one's ever going to blow out birthday candles anymore. On and on.
Some people were suggesting that maybe we would never have large gatherings again. We'd never have live concerts or theater or anything like that. And I'm living proof that we have them because I've been nonstop going to them ever since I could.
Exactly. And it's so nice. I find it so gratifying and a little vindicating, and perhaps it's a bit petty, but it just feels so good to see that there is something in the human spirit that has prevailed over this nonsense And that all these things that people said wouldn't come back have come back. I mean, even the birthday candles, even I thought that wouldn't come back. But I have been to two birthday events in the past couple of months where somebody blew out their birthday candles and then cut the cake into slices and everyone ate it. And no one even thought about COVID. And that was just so extraordinary and wonderful to me.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I was a little bit afraid that especially places with very hard lockdowns, that they would have crushed the spirit of the people to the point that normal life, so-called, just couldn't be resumed in those places because the people would have just been beaten down too much ever to really be able to resume it fully, that they'd had so much fear beaten into them. And I didn't say absolutely for sure this is going to happen. It was a fear that I had.
Yeah.
And I think that fear was misplaced because I just, most recent trip I took was to Madrid. And Madrid had a pretty heavy lockdown. I have a professor friend there. We could not leave our apartment. We could not leave. Yet that place was absolutely full of life.
Oh, so wonderful. Full
of life. It was fantastic to see. I would say in Spain, they are about, or at least I only went to Madrid and Seville, but they are about as masked as the U.S. is. So more than other European countries I've gone to where the masks are almost completely gone. In the U.S., they're almost completely gone. But there's still that holdout minority. Spain has that, it seems like. But otherwise, we went to theater, we went to restaurants, and it was, everything was packed and bustling. And I was just saying to my wife, there's life in the old place yet. Thank goodness.
Yes, I know. Yeah, big, big relief.
Hey, everybody. Today's show is sponsored by Gold Alliance. If you're concerned about high inflation, looming recession, a stock market correction, or out-of-control spending in Washington, this is an important message to hear. Because the fact is, during every major crisis in U.S. history, many of those who failed to prepare watched their savings, investments, or retirement funds go down, while many with the foresight to own gold helped preserve their purchasing power. Gold even made some folks richer. Now we're facing several major crises at once, and experts say we may soon face even more economic trouble. So please don't wait. Learn the simple way you can diversify with gold and put yourself on the road to financial peace of mind, even in uncertain times. The new free 2023 Gold Guide from our friends at Gold Alliance can show you how. Just visit freegoldguide.com/Tom or call 800-317-3808. That's freegoldguide.com/Tom or call 800-317-3808.
One thing that we haven't talked about yet, but I know that you've talked about it in some of your newsletters, is children, how we treated children in all this. And I do devote a chapter of the book to that.
Oh, yeah. You couldn't even go to the, I mean, the school thing is one thing, but you couldn't even go to the playground.
Yeah. I mean, that's absurd. And some of the things they made kids do in school, like kneel in a school in Anchorage, they made them kneel so they wouldn't be touching the desks and all that. I mean, just ridiculous things. Or making them go outside if they had been exposed in the cold. You know, just really things that are so cruel that they boggle the mind. And the whole thing in the U.S. was really got into this toddler masking. I think nowhere else in the world did that.
Yeah. And in fact, even the WHO was saying, we don't recommend doing that.
Yeah. What toddler could wear a mask properly, you know, aside from just the cruelty of requiring it? But I find it very interesting. And I know you've alluded to this as well in your writings. I imagine you would probably agree that it's adults' job to take care of children. It's not children's job to take care of adults.
Right.
And I feel that we really abdicated that responsibility. We treated children like human shields that we wanted to protect us, protect the adults. And to me, there's just something fundamentally distasteful and disrespectful of the life cycle and of humanity to do that, to treat children like that. All these frightened, scared adults wanted children to be protected so they could protect the adults, wanted children to be shielded from this virus so they could protect the adults, instead of us thinking about what's best for the children. Is it really good to pump them up with this outsized fear? Is it really good to lock them inside where they are left with their thoughts and they, you know, succumb to these horrible depressions? We just didn't talk about that. I mean, isolated people did, but it wasn't at all built into the policies. And that really disgusted me as well.
I became quite ill in 2021 for several days. And obviously, I'm fine now. It's so funny. When you're a kid, when you're like 15 and you imagine how you're going to feel when you're 50. You think, oh, everything's going to ache and you can barely move. You can't be active or right. run around or anything. And I don't know why I thought that because I feel fine.
Yeah.
I feel
yeah.
great.
Yeah.
But anyway, it never once occurred to me to say, you know, those kids shouldn't have had that baseball practice. You know, maybe I wouldn't be sitting here in the house. Never dawned on me.
I actually remember reading in one of your newsletters and I just loved it. You said, I don't want any kid to miss his baseball practice because of me. I just loved that. And that is also how I felt very strongly.
Yeah, I remember people saying, like, there are people who disliked me for the libertarian world has people who don't like old Woods here. It's hard to understand why I'm such an affable, generous guy. But, you know, it's the way the world is. And I even had a couple of people wishing for my death, which, but on the other hand, it goes to show I'm accomplishing something. If somebody's filled with that much hatred for, you know, a father of five and hoping that they become orphans, you know, or half orphans, right? Well, anyway, but I did have some people thinking, oh, well, now he'll change his mind on all the mitigation measures. But again, see, my point was not just that the mitigation measures are an infringement on freedom, but they don't seem to really do anything. Or even if they do something, it's so, could barely measure it compared to all the destruction you're leaving everywhere. So I said that all along. Why would my opinion on that have changed? They wanted me to come around and say, oh, I'm going to beat my breast. I was so wrong to say people should live. No, I doubled down on it after this.
I know. It's the same thing that happened to me. People would say, oh, yeah, that's because you haven't had COVID yet. And I always said, you know what? Even if I'm on a ventilator, I will be saying the same thing. Now, I haven't had to demonstrate that. I've actually never had COVID, which is kind of amusing because I've been doing everything and going everywhere, flying all over the world. But anyway, I still haven't had it. But I really felt very deeply that this was not just a question, oh, it's because I haven't had it, so that's why I'm talking this way. I think I was talking about first principles, about things that don't depend on my particular situation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And there is a place in this conversation, as we've obviously indicated, for philosophers, for people thinking about big issues and not just thinking about a narrow fixation with one human danger. There are many, many human dangers. And one of them is destroying your social life and cutting you off from people who give you a kind of mental sustenance. And we were being given the impression that perhaps indefinitely we would be asked to give these things up. Perhaps indefinitely because for the sake of our health, maybe we can't ever gather in crowds again. And so some of us had to say, look, maybe I could extend my life if I lived in a windowless room and I ate navy beans all day.
Exactly.
But that's not how anyone would want to live.
Well, I know. And this is why I could not wrap my head around this lockdown logic. Because really, if you take it to its logical conclusion, we should all be living in those cells and eating navy beets because we could extend our lives that way. So that whole logic was just so anti-human, I guess, is the term that I come up with. It really was.
It is anti-human.
Yeah.
It absolutely is.
That is one of the motives for writing this book because, yes, philosophers have extremely valuable things to say about a pandemic, arguably even more valuable than epidemiologists. And all these voices, the writers, the musicians, I even feature a comedian, Bill Maher, and I feature a priest as well, because all these people have perspectives that are extremely important. And that's another area that maybe we could talk about a bit, you know, the priest that I feature and religion. And I also talked a little bit about the religious Jewish dissent and noncompliance.
Oh, yeah. I was going to say a quick word about that before you jump in, because I had on the show a friend who's a lawyer. He used to be the head of the American Catholic Lawyers Association, but then that merged with the Thomas More Society. And the Thomas More Society took on the case in New York where Orthodox Jews and traditionalist Catholics from the Society of St. Pius X were both fighting against restrictions that were obviously discriminatory restrictions on religious assembly because the capacity could be only 25%, but for everything else, it was 50. Well, right away, even without examining the merits of the case, you obviously can't do that. And my friend, Chris Ferrara, I interviewed him on the show and he won that case. And it was an interesting joining of forces. And if I may add also in parentheses, Chris and I have known each other a very long time, like since the, let's say, late 1990s. We even wrote a book together. And then he and I had a really, really unfortunate and very bad falling out. And we didn't speak for like a dozen years. We just, that was it. We didn't talk to each other until this. It took COVID to bring us back together. I talked about one of his articles on my show, and then he wrote and said, "Hey, my son heard your episode and I really appreciate that." And I said, "You know what? Why don't you come back on the show and we'll have our official resumption of our talking to each other on the Tom Woods Show." And it was really fantastic. And since then, we've been perfectly cordial and it's been really nice. So I wouldn't say it made the whole thing worthwhile, but I'll say it was a silver lining. All right. So yeah, so you're talking about Father Raymond D'Souza?
Yes, that's right. And the whole religious aspect, I mean, I'm not a religious person. I come from a mainly Jewish background, a little bit of Catholic on one side. I grew up in a very sort of mishmash kind of environment. But then when my father died, my mother became more Orthodox Jewish. She sort of went back to her roots. But in any case, I'm constitutionally not a religious person. But having said that, I think that COVID helped me understand the religious perspective more than ever before. As I was reading articles written by these priests and rabbis, and it just made me understand that worldview and how, for some people, religious communion, you know, it's like IV medicine. It's essential. And to just dismiss it as inessential is just as bad as dismissing culture and gatherings and music and art as inessential. And it really helped me understand that, sort of to step outside my own needs and my own point of view. Similar with the Orthodox Jewish community, I followed what they were doing in New York and in Israel, and I had never really related to that community before. They always seemed somewhat alien to me. And I say that with no disparagement. They just seemed like sort of a different, they came from a completely different place. But then when they started talking about why they wanted to keep their kids in school, what it meant to them, because they really believe the Torah saves children and keeps them on the right path, I really started to understand them in a way that I hadn't before, which was really interesting to me. And I try to honor their perspective in the book as well.
Your point about things being essential, being not essential, I may think that something somebody does spiritually is a complete waste of time and foolish. But the thing is, if it nourishes them,
yes,
then they should have it.
Yes.
And the real danger is allowing people in public office to determine for us which things we should value. I don't want to be told by some politician what things I should value.
Absolutely. You know,
and I don't think that's their role.
No.
I don't want that. And let people value what they value.
Exactly. Yes, a whole essential distinction really brought that to light. Who are they to tell us what is essential?
Yeah. And of course, obviously, people being cut off from families and only 10 people can be at your funeral, but it's okay for people to go out and riot. Like, there's something screwed up about this. Seriously, seriously screwed up about that.
Oh, yeah. And Glenn Greenwald really picked up on that whole BLM phase, when suddenly all these epidemiologists were saying, well, this is an exception. This is more important than COVID. So we can.
Because racism is a public health issue. Are you out of your mind?
I know. That was, that was awful. And I'm really enjoying the whole lockdown files now in the UK. I don't know if you're following that, but.
Oh, I am. I did send out a newsletter yesterday where I took a little bit of the snippet that everybody's talking about.
Right.
Where Matt Hancock is saying, we're going to have to scare people. We got to get them to keep complying. And
yeah, scare the pants off.
So when do we deploy the new variant is the very oddball choice of words. I mean, it looks as if what he means by that is, when do we rhetorically deploy the new variant as a means of keeping people afraid? But my goodness, are you feeding into the quote-unquote conspiracy theorists by saying, let's deploy the new variant.
Exactly. No, I know there was so much conversation on Twitter and elsewhere about that. Some people really glommed onto that word deploy. Well, I understood it the same way that you did. Yes. When do we communicate? When do we make this a public issue? But yeah, I'm very happy that these WhatsApp messages are available. I'm very happy about that. I think it's great, timely, and we need more of this.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Let me just say for a minute what one of the real benefits of your book, Blindsight is 2020, is. There are going to be a lot of books written on COVID, a lot. I mean, there already have been.
Yeah.
And I like a whole bunch of them. And each one brings something different to the table. Jay Bhattacharya told me on the Tom Woods Show that he is intending to release a memoir on this. And he said, you know, maybe I'm doing it just for me. but I need to do it. He said, I haven't been able to up to now because I've been spending so much time testifying and advising people and flying around, but I really want to sit back and process what just happened. And so I think no matter how many books on this I read, I'm going to read the Jay Bhattacharya book.
Oh, no doubt absolutely.
Because he's such a gem of a human being.
I met him in person, actually, because I was at the Brownstone Institute conference last December. That's the publisher of the book, by the way.
Yes, yes.
So I met him in person. I'd also met him before on group Zoom calls because I'm one of the moderators for a large Reddit group called Lockdown Skepticism. And I've been a moderator since September 2020. I sometimes joke that I'm the oldest moderator on Reddit, but it's great. And he came twice to do an AMA question answer session for our group. So I got to meet him on Zoom a couple times and then in person. And he's just such a gem of a person.
Yeah.
I feature him in the book as well. And
yes.
And all the architects of the Great Barrington Declaration are just such stellar, sterling people that, you know, I often think if people had actually sat down with them and had a beer with them, maybe they wouldn't have been so vilified.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the reason I say all this is that all these people will have differing perspectives in their books. I think Scott Atlas wrote a terrific book. I think it's a really, really great insider look at Fauci and the policymaking and all that. I think it's a great book. I had him on to talk about it. But the nice thing about this book is that for those people in the world who are fascinated by this, just the way you and I are, but frankly won't have time to read 12 books, this is basically 12 books. This right here. Because it's all these different perspectives in a nutshell.
Yeah, well, I mean, yes, I did try to do something different. And although it's very heavily referenced, I have like 500 references, it is not an academic book at all.
No.
It is not. It's
very accessible.
Yes, it's sort of, you know, it has some polemic, some reported journalism, some memoir. So yes, I did not want to write an academic book.
I have been asked, now I haven't gotten a firm date on when it would need to be done, but I have a book called The Politically Incorrect Guide to American History. It came out the end of 2004. So that means that next year we are coming up on its 20th anniversary. I don't like when my books have anniversaries, because it reminds me of my mortality. You know? So it's a little bit traumatic to have a 20th anniversary coming up.
But
the publisher was saying, well, a lot has happened in the past 20 years. Maybe you want to add an extra chapter. So they want me to write one chapter that would include, because the book really only went up through the year 2000. So they want me to do a chapter that would include 9/11, Afghanistan, Iraq, the meltdown of 2008, the Obama years, the Trump years, and COVID.
Yeah, right.
And by the way, if somebody says, oh, and don't forget Ukraine, shut up. You know, we only have so many. I have my limits, you know.
Yeah, right.
So, and by the way, this extra chapter can't be any longer than any of the other chapters.
Oh, man.
So I somehow have to figure out. So I think the way I treat COVID will primarily be giving like an op-ed summary of the key points. But then I want to take, of all the charts that I shared in my newsletter over the past few years, I'm going to go back and look at every single issue I put out and find maybe the handful of the most devastating charts that completely upend the narrative we were being given. And if they say a picture is worth 1,000 words, that will accomplish what I need. The charts.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, I can listen to people's opinions all day long, but there's no getting around a chart, a scatter plot of lockdown severity versus health outcomes that shows random results. I mean, that you can argue all day long. You can't unsee that chart.
Exactly. Or now there's this chart going around that is showing that Sweden has the lowest, or certainly like right down there.
I just shared that excess mortality.
Excess mortality. And exactly. And that is so much more significant than COVID mortality, because every country measures COVID mortality, defines differently.
So, yeah.
But excess mortality, you can't really get around that.
Right.
And that really speaks volumes.
They were screaming at Sweden, screaming. And Sweden, for the most part, just refused to go along. And how about that? They end up doing the best of anybody in Europe anyway, in terms of excess mortality. Where are the apologies or the, wow, you know, I guess maybe we need some humility. Maybe we don't understand the world as well as we thought we did. At the very least, it would seem that candor compels that. And yet again, that doesn't seem to be the way compulsion works in the human conscience.
No, just doubling down. And in fact, I talk about this in the book, that I went to Sweden in the summer of 2020 just to escape Canada. Like literally, I needed to just immerse myself in a milieu that was a little less crazy. So in the summer of 2020, there was a period when Europe, the European Union, decided that there were certain countries that were going to be allowed to visit. I don't know if you remember that, you know, the safe countries and all that.
Yeah.
And the US was not on that list, but Canada was on that list. So I went on a 1 week holiday. I spent like 3.5 days in Amsterdam, 3.5 days in Stockholm, literally because I was in such despair over what was happening in the world and in Canada. I just wanted to get away. I went on my own. My husband wasn't going to come with me. He was much more okay with things at the beginning. He did come over to my point of view over time, but in the beginning, he was more cautious and more scared. Anyway, I went on my own, had an absolutely marvelous time, fell in love with Stockholm. And then I came back and I had to spend 2 weeks in quarantine for a 1 week vacation, but it was still worth it for me.
I bet it was worth it. Toward the end of 2021, I wanted to do the same thing. I was just up to here with places that were requiring the shots to get into this or that event. And the masking was still off the charts. And I just thought, I want to go back to like life that I remember from a couple of years ago. So we booked the flight, but by the time the date came around, it was like 1 week after the US had said, you can't travel to Sweden. It's too, or no, it wasn't the US. I beg your pardon. This is one case where the US was not in the wrong. Sweden said,
there are
some countries, the US, Israel, and some others, you can't come in.
Right.
So we had to postpone the trip until around May of 2022. And
so
by then, most of the restrictions had lifted, but there was still, I don't know how to describe it, but it was such a breath of fresh air. And I think I would never have probably gone out of my way to visit Stockholm before. And that would have been very, very much my loss because, as you say, what a beautiful, absolutely beautiful place. Unmissable, absolutely unmissable.
I agree. Same thing here. I'd never thought of visiting Stockholm. And then it just became this big priority. And it was just lovely. And I was so lucky with the weather too. I had 3 days of absolutely gorgeous, sunny, 27 degrees in centigrade. So high 70s and Fahrenheit, 80 degrees weather. It was glorious, just glorious.
Yeah, it may be my favorite European trip ever, honestly. And so walkable. I could leave my hotel
and I could
go to the old town and within 10 minutes. I could find shopping. I could do it. It was, anyway, I'm sorry, but I'm getting a little bit off topic here, but it made me go places and also meet people I would never have met otherwise. So it's like, I had a trip to Ireland scheduled also for 2020. That one went by the boards. But if I ever am able to do that, reschedule it, then I want to say hi to Ivor Cummins while I'm there. You know, if I'm in South Africa, I want to meet Nick Hudson.
Right. Yes, yes.
All these great heroic people who took a lot of slings and arrows. We're never going to have an opportunity, all of us, to be in one room and meet each other. But one by one, I want to say some hellos between now and when I leave this mortal coil.
Yes, that is the silver lining for me as well. I've met all these incredible people that I never would have met otherwise, including the people at Brownstone, Jeffrey Tucker, and Jay Bhattacharya, and all these other people. I even formed my own group, actually, in Toronto. This is how desperate I was. I formed a group called QLIT, Questioning Lockdowns in Toronto. And I got the initial members from Reddit, from this global group of 56,000 that I was a moderator on. Some of them were from Toronto, so I would invite them to this group. And then it grew, and at our highest, we had like about 110 members. And we had a lot of meetups, and we had a WhatsApp chat that never slept. Literally, like there was 500 to 1,000 messages per day. Anytime I would go on my phone, there was people exchanging messages. That's how much of a need it was for those of us for whom the measures hurt or stole. So you do what you got to do.
It made me happy to hear when I was listening to Eric Clapton, the great guitarist, talk about what it was that got him thinking and what it was that affirmed him in his opinions. And he said that he started watching videos from a guy named Ivor Cummins. And I thought, okay, I now have only one degree of separation from Eric Clapton because I know Ivor Cummins. I've had him on the Tom Woods Show. He's listening to the same people I am. This is so great. So fun. Or, I mean, for heaven's sake, I would never have had Right Said Fred, you know, who sing the song I'm Too Sexy. I would never, you know, from, and it's on Shrek and whatever. And then they did I'm Too Smurfy for the second Smurf movie and all that. I would never in a million years would I have had them on or been able to get them on. And now it's like I wrote them a little note the other day and they wrote right back. And I thought, what kind of world is this? I can write to these people all of a sudden. But it was almost like they know they can't rely on their friends in the music industry anymore. So you got to get friends where you can find them these days.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's a great silver lining.
Well, I feel like I have kept you longer than, let's say, I pledged to. So I will leave it with this. I'm going to link at tomwoods.com/2295 to Blindsight is 2020, Reflections on COVID Policies from Dissident Scientists, Philosophers, Artists, and More. A very, very worthwhile book. And also the kind of book when you're trying to explain 2020 to 2022 to children who haven't been born yet or are too little to understand, this will be something that will help get them up to speed quickly on what happened, how it happened, and we hope the kind of mindset we might adopt to prevent it from happening ever again. So, Gabrielle Bauer, I appreciate your time and your effort here. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you.
And thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.